This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Hello, and welcome to Community Matters. I'm Jane Herring, and I'm really excited today that we're talking with the new executive director of the Kenosha Public Museums. And we're going to learn a little bit, of course, about the museums, but even better, going to learn a whole lot about Leslie Brothers, who is the new executive director. So welcome to the program, Leslie.
Thanks, Jane.
And I know this is a welcome back to Kenosha because you grew up here. We're going to talk a little bit about your memories of Kenosha and what might have changed over the years. But it's important to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about when we say the museums, the Kenosha museums. So perhaps, Leslie, you can start with that and tell me what you're responsible for.
So, Jane, I just want to say, for fear of not remembering to say this before we log off, I've had a 30-year career working in museums, and I always say, because it's true, I've been really lucky in that I have worked at some outstanding institutions. I've worked with truly remarkable people, relationships that have changed the course of my thinking around museums and what they do. I've had opportunities to travel all over the world through these jobs. And so I want to say that, and then I want to say that the Kenosha Museum's position is no exception. I have found in the 5 weeks that I've been at the museum that I will have the good fortune or have the good fortune of working with truly exceptional people. So my job is a department head, actually, in the city of Kenosha. So the executive director is a department head, and the responsibility overall is to lead the museums to very, you know, successful operations in every conceivable way. But my good fortune is that I don't have to do that alone. So I work with about 18 full-time staff and 30 part-time staff. So one of the things that is really different and new for me in this job is absolutely the size of the staff. And I must say that they are all museum professionals. They all love their jobs, which is pretty fantastic for somebody coming into a new position, right? You know, I just thank my lucky stars. And what I keep promising them is that we're going to keep it that way. So the three museums consist of the Kenosha Public Museum, which is a natural history museum, world cultures, and fine art. So fine art is probably the smallest part of the museum's collections. But as someone who has worked in art museums for 30 years, I'm really grateful that it's there. So they offer changing exhibitions, a broad range of classes and workshops, as you know, Jane, because you you teach there. And the age range, as extraordinary as it may sound, for the three museums is pre-K to 90.
So it's great.
Your audience can wrap their heads around that. That's quite a challenging range to serve, and the staff of the museums do it. They actually do it. So the Kenosha Public Museum also features the Children's Field Station, which is a very special place. And if you haven't been to the museum and you haven't visited recently, the field station is fairly new and kind of a brilliantly conceived interactive space for little kids to learn about everything from fossils to art to pioneer life. The Dinosaur Discovery Museum has the nation's largest display of meat-eating dinosaurs. So it tells the story of avian life and meat-eating dinosaurs. And they have a special feature, which is the story they tell on Little Clint. Little Clint is a baby T-Rex. So a whole lot to discover there. And both of those museums are free. The average attendance now at the Kenosha Public Museum is a little over 100,000 visitors a year. The Dinosaur Discovery Museum, a little over 40,000. And then there's our wonderful kind of brilliant Civil War Museum, which focuses on the upper Midwest. And there really is no other museum specializing in Civil War history that does this. So consequently, we're nationally recognized. We are a tremendous resource for authors, scholars, historians, reenactors. And we, of course, have the very well-known 360-degree movie, Seeing the Elephant. So the Civil War Museum has an entry fee, a fairly small entry fee. It is $9. And then if you're a Kenosha resident, it is $5. And the average attendance there is a little over 50,000. So, you know, between three museums, we're looking at about 250,000 visitors a year. And I think before, you know, 2019, in the final report that I've looked at, it was over 300,000. So it's kind of mind-blowing to me that these 18 full-time staff and 30 part-time staff are able to manage this. So
that is for sure. I mean, I think that's been done through, you know, excellent planning and of course, excellent execution. And, you know, I think people, our listeners, need to kind of put those numbers that you gave into perspective when you think that the population of Kenosha is only about 100,000. So you're talking a lot of visitors coming, and I think when the museums were being promoted prior to construction of them, they were throwing around these numbers of visitors per year. The thing is those numbers are being met with excellent programming, and that's even... You mentioned, yes, there's lower numbers now than prior to the pandemic, but they're really coming back. I didn't realize that. That's excellent.
They absolutely are, Jane, actually. Thanks for making that point. Yeah, they're definitely accelerating, and everybody's talking about it. Like, okay, it's, you know, they're coming back, and, you know, we need to get ready for it. So it's, I say that the museums are in constant motion. And at the Kenosha Public Museum, which is where my office is located, it's kind of extraordinary to me because my sort of perfect idea, you know, of what a museum sounds like is now something I experience every day. So I hear, you know, the chatter of kids laughing, screaming sometimes, you know, they're talking across the lobby space, and I just love it.
It makes learning a fun activity, and I think that's it. When you're talking about your excellent staff, it seems like that's what they're dedicated to, is not only for little kids but adults, to have them sort of accidentally learn because they're enjoying it so much they don't realize, oh, this is education.
Right. No, that's an excellent point. You know, learning from objects is something, you know, those of us who work in museums, I think it's one of the greatest parts of this experience is recognizing and knowing the value of learning from objects for all of those ages, and how it opens so many doors and so much potential for how especially young people can imagine themselves in the world and what's waiting for them out there.
I had questions, I'm not sure of the order I want to ask them anymore, because you're talking about this great atmosphere and environment for learning at the museums, and I want to ask about your more recent background in fine art museums, and I want to find out perhaps how some of the things that you had implemented in your past, like you say, 30 years of museum work, do you see opportunities for integrating it into our museums? And I hardly know where to start with that. So I'm going to ask you to just do a little bit of an interrupter here and ask you some specific questions about your last position or so and the types of things that you did.
Well, so if I can kind of lead into that, you know, I want to say, people often ask those of us in the field, you know, how did you get into working in museums? Did you always want to be a museum professional? And no, I think for many of us, you know, we come into it by never turning down certain opportunities that are offered to us. And so, you know, when I graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee with a degree in art history and also French, so I had two majors, art history and French, and I have to kind of tuck in an aside here. So having the French language and France as something that I know very well and it's a big part of my life is a gift, I have to say, that Louise Mattioli gave me back at Fremper High School. And I hope if anybody's listening to this that knows Louise, they'll share this with her. So the passion for the French language really started there. And it's through the Wisconsin University system that I was able to do a study abroad in Paris while in college, and received a certificate of studies from the Sorbonne, and then began a lifelong relationship with the language and the country. So I just want to put that out there as an aside. But after I graduated from the University of Milwaukee, a friend of mine who lived in New York City said, hey, I need a roommate and you're not doing anything, you know, and so you're working at Beans and Barley and, you know, no plan for the future. And so I said, okay, great, sounds good. And I moved to New York City. I had about 3 months worth of cash stash to survive. And I, having limited skills, and fortunately one of them being that I could speak French fairly well at the time, I got a job working for Lucian Goldschmidt, who was, he's no longer with us, but he was the most important dealer in old master prints, drawings, and rare books in North America. Ooh. And he had a gallery space on 82nd between, on Madison Avenue, sorry, between 82nd and 83rd. And he needed someone who could answer the phone and speak to his French clients. So, you know, here I was, this sort of green girl from Wisconsin with no experience really working at this kind of amazing gallery space for this truly remarkable individual. And, you know, these are the things that I think can happen in our life that sort of lead us to where we go when we stay open, you know, to opportunities that kind of come our way. And I think in my, you know, existential journey, that has, that happened many, many times. So from New York, I made my way to graduate school at Virginia Commonwealth. I got a master's degree in 20th century art theory and criticism. And the point was to actually learn how to write about contemporary art. And Richmond is a place where you can't really throw a rock without hitting a museum. And so it was a really wonderful place to do internships at a whole bunch of different places, sort of get an understanding of whether this was really a field, you know, that I wanted to go into. And so I took really full advantage of that, including working at the Brooklyn Museum of Art one summer and also the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. So eventually, you know, kind of working my way through the profession, really wanting to get experience doing every aspect of museum work. So I got a job as a registrar, an art handler, I built crates, and I also did some curatorial work. And then I moved on to the U of I, the Krannert Art Museum. I was their curator of contemporary art there. And I had all kinds of opportunities at the Krannert to do publications. And I created what was the Contemporary Art Series, which were four exhibitions with kind of young, new artists each year that also had a little catalog. And I traded catalogs with those artists for works of art to be accessioned into the collection. So it was kind of a cool thing. I also worked really with some extraordinary people. You know, the U of I is a kind of extraordinary place. I had a great experience there, but I decided, I mean, it was clear to me that I had ideas about, you know, the kinds of questions that I thought we should be asking in museums and the ways that we should be thinking about how we move forward and why we do what we do. And so I needed to have, you know, a little more authority to be able to try those things out. And so the next job I got was at the McDonough Museum of Art in Youngstown, Ohio, and I was their director and somehow stayed there for 17 years, which I still find surprising. But in every place I've been to, it's always been about being able to do really good work. And in Youngstown, I was able to do, I think, the work that really transformed my career, really transformed, you know, the way that I think and feel about museums and their capacity to connect with their communities. And so the much like really Kenosha in some ways, Youngstown was in transition. It was sort of the last city on the Rust Belt to really kind of, you know, pull itself up. The university was located right in the middle of the city, right in the middle of the downtown, that had been kind of abandoned and just really was in desperate need of some caring. You know, everybody had moved to the suburbs and kind of left those, you know, folks behind. And so the university was committed to participating in the transformation of the city. So I decided that the University Art Museum had a significant role to play in that. So for 10 years, and I gave a TED talk on this, so if anybody's interested, you can find it on YouTube, TEDx Youngstown, Leslie Brothers, on how mattering can be transformational and how caring about what matters to people in your community can be a really powerful way to connect to the museum through civic engagement. So for 10 years, I really was able with my tiny team, there were just two other full-time people, able to do some really extraordinary things with the community around things that matter to them within, you know, within their city. And when I left to go to Ulrich, which is what you asked me about maybe 15 minutes ago, Jane, my son had graduated from YSU, and we did that. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time to, you know, do something else, you know, another challenge. And the Ulrich Museum of Art was a fairly traditional kind of museum in that it had a collection, it has a collection of about 6,700 objects. It is a modern and contemporary art museum located on the campus of Wichita State University. And I will say that 90% of the institutions I've worked at up to this point have been university art museums. And there's a reason for that. In that, you know, I believe being connected to these universities that consider themselves urban research centers, the University Art Museum then can imagine itself, see itself, conduct itself in that same way. And I continue to believe that museums are actually highly experimental. And I've talked to the staff about that thinking that we come out of this, you know, past that kind of puts forward, you know, museums like the Met, for example. You have the grand stairway that takes you up to, you know, the magnificent entryway, and then there you have things from the beginning of time. And the idea is that, you know, we are not. Changing, you know, we are, you can depend on the museum for, you know, having the best information. And I think, you know, actually we are truly more experimental, especially now in the 21st century, and more in need of rethinking on a regular basis just about everything that we do. So at the Ulrich, I was able to do some really great things. And again, I had a staff that was up for it. And we kind of branded our time there as the future now. And we did projects at the museum that featured research. My call was kind of to connect the museum to the curriculum, and not to deny our relationships with the community, but to be more of a resource for students, faculty, and staff. And so I'll just give you one example. we put together a series of exhibitions called Solving for X. And as we all know, right, X is this variable. And so for us, X would be four different exhibitions that featured research that was being done by faculty on campus. And they were true collaborations in that we worked together to figure out how to visualize, for example, research the geologist was doing around acid mine drainage remediation, right? So, okay. So we worked together to figure out how to make that research visual and accessible for the public. So when people came into the museum and our ground floor gallery, they wouldn't find an exhibition of contemporary art, but they might find something that they could really relate to kind of immediately, something that might be found in their life experience. And then our hope was that as they moved upstairs to the upper galleries, they might be more ready, more open for the, you know, far more challenging, often far more challenging work of contemporary art. So Solving for X, I would say, was also an experimental effort, and it worked out very well. People really seemed to love those exhibitions, and they gave them sort of a sense of belonging through recognizing these subjects that were already kind of familiar to them. So another one was on gerrymandering. Another one was on memories of our mothers and our grandmothers. And a third one was around an app that a bioengineering professor designed for blind and visually impaired people to be able to move around spaces safely. So I think in telling you about this work, it might give you an idea of why, when this job came up, I found out about it. I was told, you know, hey, did you see this job that's, you know, come up in your hometown? And I wasn't really looking for a new job. I had raised about $360,000 to transform our first floor lobby space and conference room into a collection study center. And that was well underway. It was really kind of thrilling for all of us to, you know, to imagine having this new facility in the museum that would really, you know, transform the museum for forever. And so it was an exciting time, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop thinking about the challenge of you know, kind of being the umbrella over these three museums. So different and so fascinating. And you know, it connected to, I think, for my whole career in being interested as much in the art, if not more, in where the art comes from. So this was sort of the answer. It was to kind of do the full out dive into the world of where the art comes from. And so I thought, you know, it would mean being back to that lake that has, you know, been in my consciousness my whole life. And it would mean being with family, of course. But at this point in my career, to have an opportunity like that, to really make a shift, to really sort of start so many new things, was for me kind of irresistible. And so I thought, all right, I'm gonna throw my hat in and give it a try. And it worked out, Jane.
Yay, you are here. You know, actually, there's a lot of things I want to pick up on and what you had been saying earlier that I think as we're looking forward to having you bring all of this great experience into Kenosha and work with the staff to enable them to kind of deliver on perhaps some new programming or a different way of focusing some of the energy. Two things that I particularly heard from you were how you connected with communities. And another one is, you know, questioning why do we do what we do? And it seems those two ideas really meld together to look at what people want and what their needs are, what their curiosities are. You had done the whole thing with the university, playing over what major things were happening within the academic world. I could see where you might take what is happening in the community and find ways of building on that in the museums based on what your experience has been. Why are you doing it? How are you melding with the community needs? Is that kind of your main goal?
Yeah, I think that work in Youngstown, go back to that, working with the city officials, the Center for Working Class Study, the Urban Planning Department, other universities, Kent State, and their urban planning programs, all the folks who were involved in kind of rethinking Youngstown and its future, I had to kind of recognize that that was really, I think, a very special time in my life, and that I really loved doing that work. And even though museums in the 21st century have partnerships now, you know, it wasn't necessarily our history, but museums as a whole recognize that we, in order to expand our audiences in meaningful ways, we need to work with the organizations in our communities to reach people through sort of mutual caring, you know. So in Ulrich, we were working with neighborhood associations. We worked with Empty Bowls. We worked with the Boys and Girls Club. We worked with the public school system, of course. The Center for Combating Human Trafficking, Juvenile Detention Center. I also work with the juvie justice system in Youngstown as well, and found both of those experiences to be really rewarding. So I think, you know, it's common. You know, we talk about working with community, but I think it's really part of what museums do and who they are now, you know, a natural part of what we do. So we're not singular and alone in any community. We're connected to these organizations. So, I think that's a consistent part of it. And the Kenosha Public Museums have many partnerships. And in fact, I asked the staff if they would start sending me lists of folks that they've worked with recently and over time. And I think I have about 150 so far, and I've only maybe gotten lists from three staff people. So
wow,
that gives you any sense. Yeah, so I think we see ourselves as not having that obligation, but having that need, that desire to make connections that are powerful and sustainable, really, most of all, you know, sustainable by working with other organizations within the city. And that would be, you know, the History Center, that would be the Milwaukee Public Museum, you know, our peers, our peers, you know, within the region, and nationally. So, you know, yeah, our world is large, you know, it's vast.
Yes. And you're starting to answer that question about what are your goals for the first 6 months? What are you planning to do? Well, it sounds like even within the first 5 to 6 weeks, you're finding out who the museum partners with. So you better understand the position of the museum within the community and how those partnerships might grow. What else are you doing?
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for asking. So I've been meeting one-on-one with each member of the staff. And those meetings have been no less, I would say, than about 2 hours. And it's been extraordinary. And having the time to do that, you know, was kind of something that I said straight out of the gate, I really want to do, and I want to do it right away, because I know that it will get more and more difficult to have the time to, you know, just sit in my office and say, hey, you know, tell me about yourself, you know, tell me about the work you do here, right? So that's been really moving and inspirational and so great for me to be able to get to know these people and have a sense for them, you know, straight out of the gate. So I haven't met with everyone yet. I have probably about 5 or 6 more people to meet with. So I'm doing that. And we are also working on our 2023 budget. So that's happening now. We are also going to begin probably in the next week work on a 5-year strategic plan. So we are definitely in need of that, which will, I think, be just a really exciting experience for all of us to kind of come together around the things that, you know, we all have declared we care about and what our core values are and how we want to move forward. So I'm really, really excited to do that with this group. And then, you know, sort of second phase to share that with our stakeholders and our constituents. So that's happening. I'm also meeting with the 3 boards that I am responsible for, I answer to, I take care of. So I have met with the Board of Trustees. They oversee our operations, and they're a great, great group of people. I have had a first meeting with the Friends of the Museum Board, and unfortunately it was through a phone connection, but they all sound really dedicated and caring about the museum. So we have a membership at about, I believe, 820 members now. So for your listeners, gosh, it's great to belong to your local organizations, and we have so much to offer our members, so something to think about. And then there's the Foundation Board, and this is a group of people that I will say has been spinning straw into gold for maybe 15 years now, and have built up an extraordinary fund ongoing for the museum's support. So those are the things that I've been doing in the first 5 weeks.
And very busy.
Yeah. I think also walking around just, you know, with this kind of deer in the headlights look on my face.
A couple of things that you just mentioned there with the different boards, and it's hinting at financial support of the museum. And again, for our listeners who don't really know for sure the funding, we know it's a city department. However, you have a foundation and a friends group who also have some fiscal contribution, correct?
Yeah, so I can kind of lay it out there simply. And it's actually, it's similar, even though it's not the parent institution, it's the city, as opposed to the university, which is funded by the state. But it's similar in that the museum receives some funding from the city of Kenosha through a tax levy, and that money goes directly to cover staff salaries, fringes, benefits, some of the staff salaries, fringes, and benefits. And then the museum receives a distribution from the foundation each year, and those funds also help to cover staff salaries and fringes. Our budget is just under $3 million. So I guess I should say that so that there's perspective. So our budget's just about $2.8 million. A good bit of that, as anybody, you know, who knows can understand, is to pay for salaries, fringes, and benefits. And then the rest the museum raises. So there's the membership fund. That's about, I don't know, $35,000 a year. Then through classes, tours, events, fundraisers, donors. The museum has a growing list of donors that started way back at the beginning. People in this community and beyond who have been supporting the museums all along, kind of just a really impressive list of individuals. So we raise, I would say just under, maybe a third, we raise a third of the funds that it takes to do what we do in the community. Each year.
And that takes work too, work of many people to coordinate that and to seek it out and do grant writing and all sorts of fun stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
So we have just about a minute left, and I do want to give you an opportunity to say something about what your number one hope is for serving as executive director.
Oh, well, okay, if I can do this right, you know, the staff of the museum will feel empowered, they will feel supported, and therefore they will feel like, as museum professionals working in those three museums, the sky is the limit. And so together, we will do really great things with our partners and with the community. So I think, you know, there's always a lot of talk about museum directors and their visions, and but I think we all would secretly agree, you know, that it's so dependent on empowering our staff and making sure that they're supported and they have what they need. And so really on a very basic level. And then, you know, there's the broad range of things that executive directors of museums need to care about. And that's everything from the HVAC system to the plumbing to, you know, whether, you know, we're getting those raises for our staff, you know. So it's
all encompassing, isn't it? Well, we're really happy though that you came aboard. You welcome Pusha. And I do want to let our listeners know that we've been talking with Leslie Brothers, who is the new executive director of the Kenosha Museums. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
And that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.